The worries over exposures to the toxic chemicals after the Ohio train derailment bring to mind the work of environmental hero Rachel Carson, who wrote about the indiscriminate use of pesticides and other chemicals and their consequences in her book Silent Spring. A new memoir traces a life inspired by Rachel Carson. Patty DeMarco has had a 50-year career in energy and environmental policy. She was the executive director of the Rachel Carson Homestead Association and director of the Rachel Carson Institute at Chatham University in Pittsburgh, where she's now senior scholar and adjunct faculty. She's also the vice president of the Forest Hills Borough Council. In her book, In the Footsteps of Rachel Carson, Harnessing Earth's Healing Power, DeMarco opens up about her career and personal life, and I had a chance to speak with her about it recently. The first part of your childhood was spent in Pittsburgh's Mount Washington neighborhood. My mouth was practically watering at your descriptions of the figs and tomatoes that your extended Italian family grew there, and especially the meals your grandmother made. What did your grandmother and your mother give you in those years that you took into your life and your career in environmentalism?
I always felt I was part of the garden. My earliest memories are from walking around in the garden with my nonna, figuring out what was ripe today. She said, "We're going to go get some stuff for dinner." And, you know, we would go out, and I remember being knee high, you know, to her. We would pick the little zucchinis that were only a few inches long, because if you let all of them grow to be gigantic, they're tough. So, you know, I really took away from the experience of growing up like that a sense that you are part of the natural world and you carry that connection. So everywhere I went, I looked for what can I connect to? What is my ecosystem around me? What are the living things that I am amidst in all the different places that I lived? And also from my mother as well, using meals and that society around the table. Dinner parties are a great public policy tool. And all of the problems of the family were settled at my grandmother's table on Sundays, you know. And my mother also, because we were in the diplomatic service, I mean, she threw dinner parties like you wouldn't believe. And of course, I was the sous chef. And once I was old enough to chop or cut anything. So the concept of using that gathering around food as a way of building community, as a way of building connection.
Yeah, when you were 10, your father took a job in the Foreign Service and you lived all over the world, including Brazil. What was your life like there, and how was it similar to the way Rachel Carson grew up in Western Pennsylvania?
Her family was very protective of her and very possessive of her. So was mine. I mean, they controlled who we played with. They controlled, because we lived out in the middle of the jungle. Everybody else lived in town, right? And then, you know, when you're 12, 13 or so, you're becoming bonded with your peers normally. Your teens, you know, your girlfriends are your most important people. Didn't happen in our family because we moved every couple of years. So you never got that tribe. And so, like Rachel Carson, I was a little apart. And also, there are not many 12-year-old kids in a Catholic school that are interested in the bugs. I know one time this absolutely beautiful moth was kind of injured in the playground at lunchtime, and I wanted to save it. Okay, so I picked it up and I rescued it and I put it over in the bushes. And of course, it fluttered right back down because it had a damaged wing. And one of the boys came running by and stomped it flat. And I just sat down and cried. I was so upset, you know. And kids did not connect to things that I got excited about. So I felt a little bit like Rachel Carson, that I found solace in connecting to the natural world because it didn't criticize. And it was abundantly rich in new experiences. I mean, getting a microscope for my birthday was just, it opened a whole new world. And I fell into my microscope and really never came out. I became really, really interested in probing those intimate little details of the natural world.
You write about the negative reactions you got for staying in Pittsburgh to finish your PhD in biology while your first husband worked on his internship in Connecticut after medical school. And then later how having two small children sort of removed you from the academic tenure track in the 1970s. How did that change the trajectory of your career?
You know, when you study to get a PhD in a science, your expected trajectory is that you're on a tenure track, you get tenure somewhere, and your prestige is judged by the size of your grants and the number and success of your graduate students. And they don't really prepare you for much else. And when the circumstances of my life intervened such that that course was not available to me, I was really, really depressed. I mean, I thought, oh man, I've studied all these years and I have, you know, a prestigious postdoc and I had, you know, 17 publications I was associated with. So I was really well on my way. And then I had two children in close succession. And in those days, if you fall off the tenure track, you don't go back. But I found out that what you learn when you get a doctorate in a science especially is how to frame a problem, how to organize an inquiry to find out the answers, and how to communicate that. And I found there was a tremendous need for people who could translate between the lawyers, the engineers, the scientists, and the general public. And Rachel Carson was a wonderful model for that because that's what she did. I mean, she was in the Reader's Digest. She was in the local newspaper. She would explain to people about what you do with the catch of the week. You know, it was very practical, pragmatic, you know, translation of all that science into something useful for people, of everyday people.
You're very frank in the book about the four bouts of cancer, kidney cancer and breast cancer that you've gone through over the last 20 years. And you write that, like Carson, who was dying from breast cancer when she wrote Silent Spring, you decided not to let people outside of your family really know about your most recent illness. Why did you make that decision? And how has cancer changed your activism or put it into perspective?
When you're in a public position, if you have something that people consider a weakness, it compromises your ability to function. And so when I had my first round of cancer in Alaska, I was a sitting commissioner on the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and we were actually in hearings on the challenge to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff. The last thing I needed was to give the seven major oil companies who were the plaintiffs in that case an excuse to disqualify anything that I said or wrote on the record. And what it did was it made me look inward for strength instead of looking for support outward. And so I started writing, and I brought my stack of journals over here. Here it is.
Oh, wow, that's a thick stack.
And what I did was I wrote down the things that got me aggravated or scared or just mad, but I didn't talk about it. And it worked because I didn't give cancer my words. It is normal in nature. When you have like galls, a tree will make a callus around it, isolate it, and, you know, protect itself from the invasion. You have all kinds of things in nature that show you how to be strong, how to be resilient, and how to survive assaults.
There's some really lovely nature writing in the book, and I'm thinking of your time at the shore with your children, examining those little crabs and insects there, and your descriptions of the ecosystem of your yard in Pittsburgh, where you would lie on the ground as you healed from cancer. Could you read a little section from that description?
Well, sure. Thank you for asking. I had a section called The Gifts of the Healing Trees. Just to give you an idea, I have a backyard, not quite a third of an acre, in Forest Hills, and it has 200-year-old pin oaks on either side of the backyard that kind of arch over the garden and kind of the branches interconnect. And I would lie on the grass under those trees, and I would take my naps there on a little quilt. So one afternoon I did that, and I'll just read a little paragraph. I closed my eyes and felt the embrace of the elder pin oaks extend to me. These great trees form the connection between the earth and the sky. Each one an engine of carbon sequestration as their leaves turn sunlight into sugars and starches and cellulose. The miracle of photosynthesis happens here on a grand scale. In this summer of rain and warm weather, the air so close to the ground holds an earthy fragrance laced with clover blossoms and the stargazer lilies in the nearby garden border. My senses are dulled by the chemicals coursing through my body in the attempt to stifle the tumor growing in my breast. But saturating myself in all of this pulsing life lends me a sense of calm and confidence in the enduring resilience of nature. I listen to the soft gurgle of the pond fountain and receive the gift of healing sleep.
It's very Rachel Carson-esque.
You know, I practice daily meditation, just sort of sitting in the garden or walking slowly in the garden or around the neighborhood. And, you know, the act of just noticing the minutiae of the nature around you, and very aware this year of the very different winter that we've had compared to many winters. I mean, we've had, what, a total of 4 inches altogether of snow, none of which lasted more than 2 to 3 days. And I'm very, not just alarmed, but sad to see the complete progression of things that have been predicted and warned about. I mean, even as far along as Rachel Carson's time, you know, her concern was take precaution in what you do when you're disrupting the natural cycles of the world. And we have had, you know, complete oblivion to her warnings. And I reflect a lot on how much of my very strange cancer story has been caused by the environmental exposures over the course of my life. You know, I still contemplate how the consequences of our actions today will be affecting future generations.
Who did you write this book for, and what do you want them to take away from it?
Well, I wrote this book partly because I was so inspired by Rachel Carson's fortitude in dealing with a really brutal treatment for cancer. In her days, it was much worse than it is today. And she persisted even when she was suffering, you know, iritis in her eyes and had to have people read to her. And even when she was so weak, she couldn't type. The purpose-driven life gets you through the most adversity you can imagine. Rachel Carson is my model in doing that because I read many of her letters during the end of her life. She wrote voluminous correspondence with her close friends, and she shared what she did not display in public with people. And I felt like, okay, what you need to do is to focus on your purpose. And I continued writing a blog every month during the whole time I was sick. I gave, I think, 35 speeches the year that I was in chemo. And I find that when you're dealing with something as invasive and disruptive as cancer and the treatments of it, whether or not you survive the end of it, if you have an internal sense of purpose to your life that gives you a reason to get up every morning, then you're less likely to be destroyed and devastated by the experience of having a disease. And I wanted to share that with people.
Well, thank you so much for writing about that and for this book.
Thank you so much. I hope people enjoy it.
Patty DeMarco is the author of the new book, In the Footsteps of Rachel Carson, Harnessing Earth's Healing Power. There's a lot more at our website. And we didn't even get into her time working in Alaska and the wildlife she met there. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. There's a book launch in Pittsburgh on February 23rd, and you'll find more on that there, too. That's AlleghenyFront.org.